which is what Buddhism is, basically. It's Buddha's findings about things. So Buddha's approach is basically, you know, if he were sitting up here and he were Einstein, he'd be telling you about his findings, wouldn't he? He wouldn't be asking you to believe what he tells you. He wouldn't be asking you to, you know, the information that he's presenting to you wasn't presented to him from on high. He's basically presenting you his findings, and he's saying, okay, now it's up to you. Go check it out. You're the boss, not me. I'm just telling you what I have found, and if you follow this track and follow these techniques and do this and this and this, you'll come to these conclusions and you'll come to these experiences. So basically he's putting the onus on us, you know. We are the boss. He's simply presenting to us what he has found to be so. So therefore the approach has to be a very reasonable one. Very, you know, so in this room, the information that's being said here, hopefully, well, it's meant to be practical advice. Practical advice. And maybe there's 1% of it you find useful. That's cool. Maybe 100% you like, so you'll keep coming. That's up to you, you know. It's not a question of merely liking it. It's not a question of believing it. It's a question of listening to it and trying to see the practical application of it. Because it's meant to be practical advice. Like if this were cooking class, you'd be a bit disappointed if I spent the whole day raving on about chocolate cakes but never gave you a recipe. Kind of a waste of time, you know? So that's the approach. That's the way to listen to this information. Practical advice. Practical advice. Okay, so this what does it say? Good heart. Sounds nice, doesn't it? And of course, because it sounds nice, and when we think of compassion, we think of kind of this kind of gooey, nice thing. We might even think of tears, you know? But somehow the developing of it is not so comfortable. And why not? Why is it? What is it? In other words, what is it in us that prevents me from having empathy with someone else? Because, you know, compassion, you could basically say, and this is an interesting point in Buddhism, these words we use, good heart, compassion, love, all these words, they're words we all are very familiar with. But Buddhist psychology is quite precise in the way it defines things, you know? So the Buddha would say that compassion basically is like empathy with the suffering of another. Or more specifically, you could say within your mind, which is what you can cultivate, all the practices enable us to cultivate this, it's this wish that others be happy. So if you see someone, wish they don't suffer. If you see them suffering, then this connection with them, a feeling of their pain, you know? That's what you say broadly is compassion. But specifically, it's a thought, a wish, may they not suffer. And then there's an even more radical level of it that they call actually great compassion, which is a bit like the compassion that mums and dads have, you know, mothers and fathers for their children. Not only do you see the suffering of your child, but you don't sit there thinking, well, who's going to make them better? Who's going to help them? You know it's your job. That's great compassion. So they call that's what they call in this, you know, Buddhist kind of this tradition where they talk about altruism and compassion, the compassion wing. The Buddha says a bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. So compassion, this is the unique characteristic of this level of it. It's not just seeing suffering, not just having empathy, but even the courageous attitude of what can I do to help. That's really quite powerful. And that takes time. Now, we can also say this compassion comes along with another characteristic, which is a word we are really familiar with, which is called love. But right now, the way we use this word, it's used in a multitude of ways, and the Buddhist view would be, often we mean attachment. And that's a discussion we'll have in a second. So love in Buddhist view is it's like the flip side of compassion. You see a person who's happy and you delight in their happiness, just like you see a person suffering and you feel their pain. So one is compassion, one is love. So love is related to happiness. And then you've got, more specifically, the wish, may they be happy, or then the delight in their happiness. And then, of course, if you like, you can call it great love, this extra level of love, where you think, what can I do to give it to them? You know, there's this little prayer we just said, the four immeasurables. We did the shorter version, where we said, may all sending means not suffer, may they be happy. That's this view, this one. But there's a slightly extended version of that little prayer, which is very marvellous thoughts to have. It says, you know, may all sending beings be free of suffering and its causes. No, what is this? What does it say? How do you do the long one? What's it say? Oh. No, that's the third line. It's like, May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May they be free. I will make this happen. I will do it. That's this powerful level. That's this powerful level. I will do it. May I do it, you know, this strong aspiration. It's quite powerful, actually. It's quite courageous, actually. You know, they talk about these beings on this path who are fully developed in this love and compassion. They're called bodhisattva, Sanskrit word meaning, you know, person who's fully developed in this love and compassion or becoming fully developed. And that's the courageous attitude. And it's the extra level of it that really makes the difference. You see the poor person, you see their suffering, you empathize with it, and then you think, what can I do? So you give them $5, you know. 20 is better these days. 5 won't get you much. Forget about 50 cents. That's embarrassing. 1920s, you might have given 50 cents. Anyway, that's what great... In other words, you put your money where your mouth is. That's great compassion. You put your money where your mouth is. What can I do? It's very powerful, actually. So, okay, we listen to these things and we think, isn't that sound so noble? We hear about people who are compassionate and loving. Oh, I would love to be like this. So let's look at, you know, it's great. That's it. But why is it we find it so hard? That's the crucial point. So this is where we really got to, you know, the wisdom wing is where you do all the work on yourself to prepare yourself to really then go to the higher level, which is the compassion wing. It sounds lovely to be loving and compassionate. We like to think of doing nice meditations on love and compassion, you know? Have we got a chair? Have we got a chair, sweetheart, or a cushion? Okay, good. So by understanding in our own minds what it is that prevents us from having love and compassion is actually a very powerful method, therefore, for knowing how to develop it, you know. And so, unfortunately, this is where it gets kind of not very pleasant. When we look at what it is that prevents us, we have to label those parts of ourselves. Why is it I can't be loving and compassionate? No, okay, let's look first of all. First of all, we do have love and compassion for... one really good context for understanding this. In the various meditation techniques, and they're kind of presented in a nice, orderly, structured way in the compassion wing of how to develop these amazing levels of love and compassion. The very first technique, ground level, the foundation technique, it's one called cultivating equanimity. So a lot of these words are words we, you know, we use in ordinary daily life, but let's look at precisely the way this word is used in this context. So equanimity here is, you know, when you've accomplished it, it's like the name of the accomplishment of this particular technique. So when you've accomplished this equanimity, what it is this heartfelt recognition in your mind, genuine, spontaneous recognition, which comes from on the basis of a lot of hard work, which is what we'll talk about. It's a heartfelt recognition that enemies, friends and strangers are the same from one particular point of view. They wish to be happy and they wish not to suffer. So first of all, what's enemy, friend and stranger mean? Well, you know, this is based on Buddhist psychology. The three main neuroses in our mind, the three delusions, the three negative states of mind, the three essential ones that are the basis of our own suffering and indeed are the obstacles to why we can't love and have compassion for all beings, you know, they are attachment, aversion, and then there's an aspect of the main delusion, which is called ignorance, but the aspect of it here is kind of like indifference. And so what are the objects of those in terms of sentient beings? Well, guess what? The object of attachment is called a friend. The object of aversion is called an enemy. And the object of indifference is called a stranger. Pretty simple. And you won't find a fourth category of sentient beings on this earth. That covers everybody. In other words, there are those who do what we want, and that's why we have attachment to them, and that's why we love them. They're the object of attachment, the friend who looks lovely to us, whom we go towards, we gravitate towards, and whom we do indeed then want to be happy and want not to suffer. And that's about it. That's the only group of people we want to be happy and want not to suffer. So we do have love and compassion now, but as Lama Zopa Rinpoche puts it, it's unstable. Or as we'd say, it's got strings attached. It's a really nice phrase. I think Buddha would have liked that. It's got strings attached. In other words, as long as you are kind to me, as long as you do what my attachment wants, I'm going to love you for sure, and I've got a big vested interest in loving you, because and it sounds kind of cruel, but if we really unpack and analyze the way we are, it's pretty accurate, you know. So of course I love my friends. I want them to be happy, and I want them not to suffer, and I will indeed spend time and go out of my way to do that. That's the way it is. And then of course we assume, well, that's normal. Now what about your enemy though? What about, you know, the guy who, what about your ex-husband who gave you up for a younger version? How do you feel about him? Well, for sure he is no longer under the friend category, is he? He's under the heading called enemy. And there's no way you would say, oh, I love him. There's no way you would say, I wish he didn't suffer. In fact, it's the opposite. You're hoping and praying that she will leave him, you know, and leave him like he left you. I mean, you get my point here. We struggle against it, but look at the instinctive responses we have to the person who has not done what our attachment wants, which is called the enemy. I mean, we mightn't use the term enemy. It sounds quite heavy, you know, but get the meaning here. It's the person for whom we have aversion. And aversion is the basic state of mind beneath anger, in this case, or we could say depression. So, you know, depression is more like you're the object of your aversion. You're the enemy, isn't it? We're very familiar with this one. But from this point of view here, we don't discuss ourselves. We're looking at others, our response to others in this world. So we've got those who we call our friends, whom we adore, whom we're close to. And indeed, they can be under the enemy category sometimes. We know that. Whom we have attachment for, but whom we also love. Then there are those who don't do what our attachment wants, basically. Whom we have aversion for, depending on the degree. Whom we don't want to be happy and whom we don't want not to suffer. We try to feel neutral about them, but it's quite hard, isn't it? Then you've got the third category, and let's face it, that's 99.9999% of the universe. Who are they? They're called strangers. And how do we feel about them? Completely indifferent. Couldn't care less. They could all drop dead, and as long as it doesn't affect me, I don't really mind. I know it sounds kind of harsh, but I remember on my iPad, I read my iPad these days because I travel a lot, so I don't use books. I have my iPad, and I read my newspapers. I like my newspapers. So I read the New York Times, and on the iPad, it's got the summary of the main stories. And in the right-hand corner, I caught a story one day that said, I thought, 360 people killed in, you know, drown in boat tragedy in Tasmania. Well, Tasmania is my people, isn't it? Australians. So my mind ran to that story. Oh, my God, I thought. And then it said Tanzania. And I found my mind going, oh, that doesn't matter. I sort of went away from the story again, right immediately. You understand? I mean, it was mortifying. Tanzanians aren't my people. Tasmanians are. This is how we are, isn't it? Tanzanians are strangers for me. It was very interesting to catch my mind. So, of course, I opened the story and read it and tried to cultivate compassion, you know. Of course I did. You got to. This is the point. But it's how our mind works. We have our people, we have the opposite to our people, and we have 99.99%, which is the rest, who are total strangers. And what are they? They are people who've neither harmed me nor helped me. Now, if we think of this is a presentation of the world. Dogs have their friends, enemies, and strangers. Cats, mice, humans, Americans, Australians, white people, black people, Asian people, whatever category you like that we identify as me, you know? And we're pretty good at all that. We have my people, you know. Then there's the people who harm my people. Then there's the rest who do neither. This is the way we are. And this is pointing out to Buddhist psychology, and we discussed this one yesterday, the detailed explanation of how Buddha says the mind works. You've got a very precise model of the mind. And as I'm saying, the essential neuroses in the mind, the central problems in the mind, which for the Buddha are the cause of why I suffer, and therefore are the cause of why I don't have love and compassion for the enemies, not to mention the strangers. You know, and this is what you do in the wisdom wing, all the basic inner work that you do to get yourself, sort out the nuts and bolts of who you are and how you work and what causes you happiness and what causes you suffering. Because then if I can get this together and work on myself, I'm then qualified to help others. Compassion wing actually is more advanced. You know, we often think of religion or spiritual as being to do with compassion. Oh, I want to be compassionate. But we've got to know ourselves and work on ourselves really deeply first, you know, because they, in my mind, are the obstacles to why I can't have love and compassion for others. And that's why, in other words, love and compassion can sound cute, like I said, but to really work on growing it, this is not cute. It's really painful work because you're going against the instinct to only have love and compassion for your people. And it's going against the instinct to have aversion or anger towards those who harm you or harm your people. And then to even bother about the indifferent ones, whom you know, bother about the strangers, which is the vast majority of this earth. So it sounds kind of exhausting, because where we're going here in the Buddhist view, all this nice laid out structured path, is Buddha's saying we have the capacity to have this effortless love and compassion equally for all beings. I mean, this sounds exhausting. Look how hard it is to love one person. And part of our problem there is because we have this definition of love that brings in attachment, you know? So therefore it goes up and down like a yo-yo, doesn't it? It's really hard work. So let's look at then this equanimity, what it means, and just sort of this, and how you would work on your own mind to counteract these instinctive responses in order to cultivate this view called equanimity, you know? So like I said, equanimity, if you've accomplished it, would be this spontaneous, heartfelt recognition, like truly you've worked on it and now it's just really evident to you. And this is pretty advanced to be this way. So clearly it's why we have to work on it. This recognition that enemy, friend and stranger are actually the same from this one point of view. They wish equally to be happy and they wish equally not to suffer. So hearing this first, just this point specifically, or because we're intelligent, we can hear the truth of it. We can see logically that a person, maybe we can't. So let's look at this point. What does it mean they want to be happy? Because all we hear is, what do you mean, you know, if it's an enemy, if it's a mean husband who gave you up? The first thought is, what do you mean he wants to be happy? He doesn't deserve to be happy. That's what the prevalent thought is for us right now. So let's just look at even this simple concept, he wants to be happy. It's pretty fundamental. In fact, you could almost say Buddha's teachings and methods are based upon this simple, simple observation, simple truth that all beings want to be happy and don't want suffering. So here we're being more specific. We're narrowing it down to dividing the world into friends, enemies and strangers, and then using, even as we're talking, have examples in your mind as we talk. Visualize in front of you an enemy, the person who's, you know, the mean person, the person at work who's so unkind to you, the ugly, horrible auntie or the wretched next door neighbor or indeed the ex-husband, you know, the person you can call enemy. And every one of us has this. I mean, why? Because every one of us has attachment. And if we have attachment, that means our attachment won't get it what it wants sometimes, which means it arises as aversion, annoyance, irritation, or anger. So it's obvious we've all got this to some degree. And like I said, that's the work we do on the Wisdom Wing, to identify in our own minds deeply by being our own therapists. Look very deeply into this stuff. Okay, so, you know, and then so imagine in front of you a person whom you don't like, put them right there, eyeball to eyeball, right in front, don't avoid them. To the left in front of you, your dearest friend, your beloved. To the right in front of you, a stranger, maybe a person whose face you've never seen before but is in this room whom you can just put there, whom you see enough just to put there, but about whom you know nothing. In other words, a person who's neither harmed you nor helped you, for whom you are indifferent. This is the point. So then what you're doing in all these little so-called meditations, in Tibetan tradition they're called analytical meditation. But it's a very fancy term. It's a bit medieval. It's the term they use. But basically, it's a fancy term for the verb to think about. That's all it means. Don't get kind of, oh, wow, meditation, what's that? Don't worry about it. It just means use your noggin, use your brain matter, think it through, be logical. And this is truly what's employed here, is using the logic of wisdom to argue with ego's stupid views, to argue with ego's very entrenched views, which is something we're already familiar with. We do it. But these types of meditations are really laid out and very detailed and very structured. Basically, they're nothing cosmic. The hard work is done through thinking it through, really arguing with ego's very entrenched views that we don't like to give up. So it takes a lot of courage, you know. So basically, you know, in this equanimity meditation, you'd visualize the enemy, friend and stranger, And then you'd think through lots of different arguments. That's all you're doing. You're using wisdom to argue, like I said. So let's look at some of these arguments to prove how the instinct to love friend, not hate enemy, and not care about the stranger is just not logical. Logical? From ego's view, yes. Ego's logic, very strong. But not from the wisdom point of view. The Buddha would say, not from the actual point of view. So there's lots of little approaches here, lots and lots and lots. So one, for example, I find quite helpful. If you think of yourself, so reverse the picture. Here you are, there are these three people are out there, but they're all looking at you, and you think, you know, when the friend looks at you, what they see, this divine person, don't they? They see you, you know, you see them, they're starry-eyed, especially if they're in love with you. You look like the best thing they've ever seen in your whole life. So they look at you with such love, and you know, you can see in their eyes that you look gorgeous to them. Now get the ex-husband looking at you. Look at him. He can't stand the sight of you anymore. And you can tell by how he looks at you, he sees an enemy. Look at the stranger. They can hardly keep their eyes on you. You're so boring. You get my point here? So you know that even though you're one person, but for him you're friend, for him you're enemy, for her you're a stranger. So you look three different people. If they drew a picture of you, there'd be three different people there. Is it not? Do you see what I'm saying? Now, I know this sounds kind of corny, but I find it quite helpful. You know for 1 minute you're an enemy for one person, next minute you're a friend, next minute you're a stranger, but you're the same person. And you know whether you're enemy, friend, or stranger, for these three, you want to be happy every second. There's nothing in you changing, it's just their view of you changing. Well, just reverse that. And you know very well, and this is the second, another little argument, one that, you know, that they teach. You look at the friend, and all you see is gorgeous. All you see is divine person. You gloss over all the ugly parts about them. You don't see any of that attachment. Only want to see the lovely person. So, of course, you have a very nice feeling. And, of course, you're dying for them to be happy. You want them to be happy. You really love them. You really have compassion for them. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that it's based upon attachment. It's polluted, you know. So the thing is, of course, you're going to see this person, no question. You know they want to be happy and you know they don't want to suffer. But if you analyze carefully, and this is where it's a bit scary, the reason, you know, we don't think we have a reason. We should look at it logically. What's my logical reason for wanting you to be happy, that is, to love you, is because guess what? Because you make me happy. So it really has got strings attached. It's proof. Now you've left me. Now I don't want you to be happy. Whereas, you know, if I have genuine love for you, it would be stable, as Lama Zopa says. And what does that mean? It's based on a different reason. So the reason is this one here, because you want to be happy. You know yourself, it's like when your mummy, you go off with a boyfriend and your mummy says, whatever makes you happy, darling, that's love. That's genuine love. But love with attachment is you're doing what I don't want. You shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. And she gets upset with what you do because it doesn't fit her picture. So we know that's what love is, mixed with attachment. So love for this person right now is true, is valid love, but it's polluted by your craving for this person, your attachment to the person, your neediness to have them do what you want. And as long as they keep fulfilling your needs, that means he comes home on time and does all the lovely things and thanks you and smiles at you every minute and does all the things perfectly, then you will keep wanting him to be happy. So we look at this now and we see my love for him is based upon his doing what I want. So what I've got to do here in attempting to develop love, which is actually five steps on, we're looking at the foundation practice of equanimity, is to try and change my view, my reason for why I want you to be happy. Not just because you're making me happy. So to see the reason there is not a valid reason. We don't think we have a reason. I just think, of course I want him to be happy. He's adorable. I adore him, you know. But it's based on this sneaky thing called attachment, which is very deep inside us, which is this craving, this manipulating, this possessiveness, this neediness. It pollutes the love I've got, and it gives me the wrong basis for wanting him to be happy. Now, of course, so the point we've got to try and see past all that is, look at him himself. Step back out of the equation. This is what we're trying to do here in this equanimity. We're kind of get ourselves out of the equation because right now these three people are totally seen for me through the filter of my needs. So I define that person as friend only in terms of what they do to me. That's really what it is. I define enemy in terms of how they harm me, and I define stranger. It's always defined in terms of their relationship to me. Now, we think that's normal world, but it's quite shocking, actually. It's quite embarrassing, very narrow-minded. So one of the first things you could say you're trying to do in cultivating this attitude is stepping out of the equation. Try and see these three people as separate from you. Already that's pretty profound. Already that's huge, actually. And you can't really do this type of logical arguing with ego's view until you can consciously get a sense of doing that. Get out of the picture, Rabina. Back off, girl. So one of the approaches here would be, therefore, when I look at the friend whom I do consider right now as an extension of me. When you're in love with somebody, when it's your husband, your wife, your child, it's so clear they're mine. They actually are almost like me. So naturally, with huge attachment and possessiveness, I assume that they have to do what I want. That's why our mummy, who's totally attached to us, can't, if she's very attached and very possessive, can't bear seeing us do anything that she doesn't agree with. That's why she's like this, because of her masses of attachment. So we can see it in ourselves. It's huge. It's instinctive. It's mine. He's my boyfriend. He's my son. He's my friend. Look at the pain, you know, when they turn away. It's mine. This is a part of attachment, possessiveness. So step out of that, please. It's huge. Step out of that and see that this person who happens to be your beloved right now hasn't always been your beloved, excuse me. When they were born, you didn't know who they were. Even a month before you, you know, a day before you met them and fell in love with them, guess what category they were in? They were in the stranger category. They could have dropped dead. You wouldn't have cared. Oh, John, down the road, that bloke. Oh, yeah, he died. Really? I mean, it shows how ego is very foolish. But all of a sudden, because now you love him, he loves you. He's a special person. But he felt, this is the point here, he felt exactly the same before you fell in love with him. He didn't suddenly become alive since you'd met him. Oh, before he was a dead person, but now he's real because I love him, you know. No, John was still John the day before you met him. But he was a stranger for you and he could have dropped dead and you would not have worried. This is true. So it proves the narrow-mindedness of these attachment, aversion, ignorance, which we take so much for granted, you know. But all of a sudden, I see him now through the filter of my needs. He fulfills my needs. So that makes him a special person, doesn't it? But he was the same stranger before. And now, this is the point about the hubby now, the ex-hubby. Sorry, look at him. Ugly, hate him, can't stand it. It's a pain in your heart, which is understandable. When he looks at her with loving eyes now, you know, it's just like unbearable. It's like it destroys you. I understand it. It's unbearable. But look at how now we hate him. We actually want him to suffer. We want her. We hope and pray she will leave him, you know. It's too painful for us, and this is the point of attachment, that he's happy and I no longer make him happy. So we did want him to be happy when he was my beloved. I see him looking at me with, you know, dazzled eyes, and I'm so blissed out because I can see he's so happy and I make him happy. This is so powerful for us, isn't it? But now he's looking just as happy, but she makes him happy now. It's the same him. He's exactly happy as he was when I made him happy. The same happiness on his face. Listen to it. You can't argue with it. He's blissfully happy now, like he was blissfully happy when I made him happy first. But because I no longer make him happy, I can't stand to see that happiness. It's painful. It's like a personal insult to me, isn't it? This is because of attachment. This cute little word, you know, but so painful, so freaked out. So the point is when, you know, let's say he's called Fred, my ex. When Fred was in the friend category, I adored him, I wanted him to be happy, I'd sacrificed my life for him. But all of a sudden now, because the attachment has gone, now. But look, again, just like, you know, your John, who was a stranger, Fred was your friend once. Now, he's no different. He's exactly the same. There's nothing much changed. No extra grey hairs, no extra fat. He just stopped loving you, that's all. But he hasn't actually changed one fraction. Think about this logically. And this is what we have to try and do here. It's painful, but we've got to use logic because the delusions, the neuroses, are completely hysterical. There's no logic at all. They're neurotic, frantic, fear-based, panic-based, eye-based, and cause our suffering. So really painful to do this type of thinking. And that's all it is, thinking it through, being very courageous because we don't want to go to this type of thinking. It's too hard for us. And then the stranger, you can't even get your face to look at them. They're so boring, you know. Who? Oh. You walk into a room of people, you know. The first thing you do is find the friends and you run like a magnet to them. You avoid the enemies and you don't even notice the others. They just disappear into space. That's how we are, you know, friends, enemies, strangers. Not logical, Buddha says. Irrational. Eye-based. Neurotic. And the cause of all suffering and all wars on this earth. Look at the world. Enemies, friends and strangers, you know. I remember hearing Lama Zobo Rinpoche, the main lama of this center, who's and other centers around the world, you know. He heard about somebody during this tsunami years ago who had, who had gone back into the ocean to save her baby. And he said, incredible. But if she'd gone back into the ocean to save a stranger, unbelievable. And this is the kind of thing that's shocking to us because we just take it as normal that you have compassion for your baby but naturally not for someone else. And it is normal and it's fantastic. But all the Buddha's saying is we can go beyond that. We can stretch beyond that. And that's what this equanimity meditation, the very first, the foundation upon which we can grow love, compassion, great compassion, blah, 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 you know. It's hard internal work. It's very painful. And step by baby step, you know, step by baby step. So we see the friend. We observe we do love them and want them to be happy based on attachment. So what are we trying to change there? It doesn't mean this equanimity would demand that I then move out with my friend and go live with a stranger. No, doesn't mean that. In Buddhist view, you've got some karmic history with the friend. You go back home to your beloved. But you slowly work on disconnecting yourself sometimes. In your mind, getting this person out of, you know, cutting the strings and seeing this person as separate from you in a healthy way and actually realizing they like to do things that you might not like. That's why we fight with each other. Because how dare he do what I don't like? How dare he like things that I don't like? How dare he like sport and I like movies? That's why we feel resentful and get jealous and upset. Because, you know, I'm assuming he's mine, so he's got to do what I want. That's why we get upset. That's why we get jealous. That's why we get hurt and insulted. Because we're so fragile with our attachment. So stop seeing the person as an extension of your needs. This is so powerful. Then that allows you to start seeing that person from their own point of view. Look at how mothers used to tell us these profound statements. Put yourself in his shoes. Very profound. So this friend, see him as a separate person. Realize that he wants to be happy. He wants to be happy. That's the basis of your slowly developing genuine, that's what it means by genuine love. It's not complicated. Genuine love, stable love is may he be happy because he wants to be happy, not because he does what I want. Then when he does leave you, it'll be painful. It'll be really painful, but you will still be able to slowly grow that thought. Well, may he be happy. It'll break your heart, but you'll know it's true because you've practiced that. He wants to be happy. It's so profound. He wants to be happy. Then the enemy is really hard to see this because the first instinct is we feel the pain, we feel the hurt. Of course we do. We're human. So what do you mean he wants to be happy? He doesn't deserve to be happy is our first thought. That's not the issue here yet, okay? We're not in this equanimity. We're not even trying to establish whether he deserves it or not. That's not the issue here at all. What we're trying to establish here in this equanimity meditation, it's really specific that he, the enemy, also in his bones, in his mind, in his heart, in his shoes, he wants to be happy. He wants to be happy. And obviously, because he's craving to be happy, his wish to be happy, and then because he too has attachment, he too has anger, he too has jealousy, join the club. That's why he gave you up, because he truly believed falling in love with this new person was what was his wish to be happy. So it's hard for us to think this, because it means you've got to step out of the equation again and start to actually try and imagine from his point of view why he did what he did, which is enormously hard work for us. It's extremely hard, but so excellent if we can be courageous enough. Just like you. This is the thing, when you put yourself there, you think. You left somebody one time, you know, he adored you and you left him. Look at here how mad he is at you, how hurt he is. But you know in your heart, you knew it was right to leave that relationship to go to fall in, you know, to go live with somebody else. You did it with the genuine wish to be happy, to do the right thing. You didn't do it to really hurt him. Well, that's how your enemy feels. It's so hard for us, so painful to go there. So it takes so much courage to do this. We can see. Something so simple as to recognize from his point of view, he wants to be happy. That's why he did what he did, which was to harm you. For you to be harmed. He didn't necessarily want to harm you, like you didn't want to harm your ex-boyfriend, but he got harmed. So you got harmed, you know. It's very painful, but very courageous if we can bear it. He wants to be happy. That's the bare bones fact. Than the stranger, you know. Look long enough and you'll see a real living human being there with a beating heart. Wants to be happy, doesn't want to suffer. So just this recognition, even intellectually, already changes so much in our life. Stabilizes our mind, calms us down, steadies us. It's a courageous way to go, though. So courageous, because we're so caught up in our pain of attachment and pain of anger and hurt and pain and the boredom of indifference, you know. Because every time you see a bunch of strangers, if you're in love with somebody, when you see a bunch of strangers, all you see is the absence of your beloved. And you just wish that all go away. All you want to see is your beloved, you know. So we yearn for our friend again. And every time we see enemies, it's so painful to us because attachment's so needy for the beloved. So really just step out of this, in your mind even, just in your mind, in your meditation, in your mind. Step out of this. Attempt to imagine the friend, enemy, stranger and try to see them as equal in this way. They're equal, Rabina. They're equal. Not from the point of view of what they do for me. No way. But from their point of view, not mine. This is the whole compassion wing, what you're trying to do. In the wisdom wing, when you're working on your mind, you're looking at karma, you're understanding your delusions, you're in your own stuff. You're backing off and leaving sentient beings alone. Believe me, that's what you're trying to do. Back off, mind your own business, and get inside your own head and sort out the mess in there, you know. That's what your main responsibility. But here now, in the compassion wing, we're kind of getting out of ourselves and we're moving into sentient beings. And now they are our business. We continue to work on our minds, but they're our business. And we're working on our mind in reference to them now. As a technique to be able to have love, compassion for everyone and want only to benefit them, which seems impossible to us from that point of view at the moment of attachment, aversion and ignorance, of course. But so we're, you know, really trying to stretch our mind, break down the barriers between self and other. So don't ever think that compassion, meditation are kind of like cute things. They're just, you know, you might have nice compassion. But it's very sentimental compassion we have now. And it's comfortable compassion. It's compassion for people we like. And actually, let's really look at this one. You know, the compassion we have now is only for innocent victims. And that usually comes down to children and animals for most of us, I'm sorry to say. Nobody else is innocent, you know. Babies, children and animals, they're innocent. So we love to have compassion for them. So this is a very interesting point. Let's look at what Buddha means by compassion. It's kind of scary, and it's indicated already by this equanimity contemplation meditation, you know? So right now, like I said, our compassion and our love are really limited. They're based on attachment. You know, we have attachment to the objects of our attachment, children, animals, our beloveds, you know, like that. So this is a very intense point, really. 20 minutes, 20 past. 20 minutes, okay. Okay, stop right there. Any questions first? We've got time for more, but any questions? If you haven't, it's really cool. I can keep chatting. Any questions? Or is it kind of clear? Okay, good enough. No questions. But if you do have one, stick your hand up. Okay, go for it.
Maybe you can hear me.
Where's that? Down this way, darling. Jeanette. So sweet. Yes, go. Okay. No.
Ooh.
There you go. Go, talk to me.
So I think I understand. I don't know that I have in here the aversion attachment equanimity.
Yeah.
And you partially answered my question, but I wanted to expand on, yet we have special relationships with people.
We do
fall in love with people, and one can be, I presume, in love with them and have a special relationship without, and yet it be a healthy attachment.
And what?
And yet it be a healthy,
relationship.
Relationship, not an attachment.
No. Well, it's very hard. It's like, forget about giving up attachment immediately. We've got to be aware of attachment, but don't think it'll be without attachment. That's like highly advanced. We learn to work with it and go against it. So go on though.
Well, maybe that was the answer. But you also said that maybe you have some karmic history or a special bond there.
Yeah.
Does that?
You can have that.
Because obviously I'm specially attached to my wife and my children, but I think that's normal and healthy, and that's not.
That's right. So the point here, I suppose, is the clarity about the word attachment, isn't it? Because that's a word every one of us in this world, in this room here, would use, but we define it, I think, in a very different way from the way Buddhism would use the term. So that's why it's so important when I use this word, you better know exactly what I mean. I was mentioning this yesterday. We're in different systems of things like music or maths. Words we use in ordinary daily language are used in a very different way, and you better know the definition. Like when you play music, you talk about sharp and flat. It does not mean the same as like the way we talk about it in ordinary language. We've got to know the definition. So the word attachment here means, Buddhist psychology would very simply, we've got certain states of mind that are completely neurotic, eye-based, delusional, suffering, painful, and are the cause of our suffering. It's very clear, very precise. Then you've got states of mind that are virtuous, constructive, beneficial, positive, that are the cause of happiness. And then there are some that are neither, but never mind those now. So a perfect example here is love and compassion run the heading positive. They're necessarily virtuous or positive or beneficial, constructive states of mind that we're trying to cultivate that are based upon, as I said, the recognition that they want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And that's what makes us want them to be happy and want to do what we can to make them happy. So that you recognize when you think of your children, your family, don't you? So the Buddha would say, there's various things going on here. First of all, you've got a strong karmic history. You've got your mind that goes back and back and back, Buddha would say. Their minds go back and back and back, Buddha would say. And you've had a strong relationship in the past. You've necessarily been good to each other in the past. So this is what drew you to your wife, and this is what drew your children to your wife's womb. No sort of random accident. This is another whole discussion now, but this is Buddha's explanation from his own observation of how the world is the way it is. So you've got a strong history with these people. So here you are in this relationship, and you're repaying their kindness, and they're indeed repaying your kindness to them. So it's a very mutually beneficial relationship. That's where the love and compassion is. So you've got a strong history together. Then on top of that, that's the history part. That's just there. Just like you've got history there with an enemy. You know, you see two people fighting. They might as well be attached to each other. Look at, they can't pull them apart. You see what I'm saying? Look at how people, this group hates this group. That country hates this country. It's the same story. There's a strong history between those groups of people, but unfortunately they're expressing anger towards each other now. So, okay, the Buddha would say that because you're a regular, say, assume you're a regular person, they're regular people, you have got bucket loads of love and compassion. No question. That's why you don't beat them up every day and leave them. You understand my point? That's the expression of it. How fortunate you are to have that. But along with that, which is so hidden to us, which we don't even factor as a specific state of mind in our materialist models of the mind, there's this other state of mind called attachment, which is completely pervading our minds. It's completely based on I. It's the thing that drives me to do what I do. It gets up. When it doesn't get what it wants, then I get angry. These attachment and anger are underneath everything we do. But we, in Western psychology, we'd say, oh, well, we've all got a bit of love, all got a bit of a compassion, all got a bit of anger, but we give equal status to them. But the Buddhist explanation is quite different, that we need to look into these neuroses because they are the source of my pain. And they now, in this context, are the source of why I have enemies and friends and strangers in the first place. So the karmic history is why you're together. That's why if you, even as a Buddhist, you wouldn't just think, oh, well, I'm going to leave my wife and I'll go live with my stranger. No, you've got a history with her, so you've got to carry that history out. You understand my point? And maybe the stranger, there's no karmic history right now, but you might meet him in another life. Don't worry about it. But right now, your job is to this family. But the difference here is what you're trying to do is not stop loving them, but give up attachment and love them because they want to be happy, not because they're making you happy. So that needs that deep looking at. Maybe you'll even avoid that enemy who's a maniac, let's say. But in your heart, by thinking about it, you know you've harmed them in the past. Karmically, Buddha would say, you know they want to be happy, that they're suffering. And so your relationship to them in your mind is very, very different. It doesn't mean you've got to go there and forgive them or talk to them or be all sentimental. You might never see them again. And the stranger the same. In your mind, you know that these are labels that are changing all the time from life to life, and it's not set in stone. But at this moment in time, it's your job, so go for it. Love your wife, love your kids. But not because they make you happy, it's because they want to be happy. So it's a huge shift in your mind that you're trying to make. And then you can forgive your enemies, you know, and you can learn to be happy around strangers instead of just only getting what attachment wants. You understand? So it needs a lot of looking inside. It's quite subtle, you know. This is the discussion about it. Make sense? Make sense, people? Go, go. Yes. Go, sweetheart. Go, you too. Good. Go, go. Yep. Two people there. Keep your hand up. There are two people, yes. One, and then I'll pass it behind you after that. Go, darling. Talk to me.
Yes, I was just thinking about, was it a couple, two, 3 weeks ago, we were talking about awakening or the process of awakening.
Yep.
Would that be the conscious, being conscious of the ideas of what you're saying is that even the enemy, the stranger, and the friend, all want what you're saying is happiness.
That's
and it's free from suffering.
Yes.
And we're all the same in that.
Yes.
That perception of looking.
Yeah, well, that's a very nice word in Buddhism. Actually, the word Buddha is often translated as fully awake. The implication, of course, being that we're kind of fast asleep right now. And we're just on autopilot and we follow our cravings and follow our needs and get upset and get irritated and get annoyed, but never really look into it, always blaming the outside. So the whole Buddhist approach of learning to look inside and starting to factor in what's going on inside here rather than only what's going on the outside is this process, yes, of waking up. You could say that very
so
much.
So it would be partly if my initial reaction would be aggression or aversion.
The instinctive response of attachment or aversion, but looking into this and analyzing it and going more deeply and wishing to change in here, not just change out there, which is the usual way we live our lives. That's right.
So that when those feelings come up, then if I'm conscious and aware of what I'm doing,
that's
then
right.
I can see, hey, wait a minute.
You'll change them. Precisely.
And
that's
then
what
I can practice.
Precisely.
And practice is what
that's
brings
right.
on the awakening.
Precisely. And it's like, so in other words, practicing anything we know, hang on, keep the mic. It's okay. Practicing, you know yourself, practicing football, practicing piano, you just keep, you're waking up to that stuff. It's another way of putting it. You're ignorant of music, let's say, and then one day you decide you're going to be a musician. Well, it's like you're waking up to music. Oh, wow, I never knew that before. It's a really good word, actually. And then you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it until eventually that's spontaneous. But what we're waking up to here is the way our mind works and how it sees the world, which is the very basis of who we are, isn't it? That's what this is about.
Thank you.
Makes sense, doesn't it? Good.
Definitely.
Good. Cool. Go. Behind you. Yes.
Thank you. If I understood you correctly, you said that depression is aversion to the self.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? Shall we look at that?
Yes. How do you overcome it?
Okay. In the same way, I mean, it's very, you know, this is, well. I've got 10 minutes. This is kind of, okay, gosh. The answer to the last question, how you overcome it, is a bit like the answer to how you play piano. If you had to learn to play piano, you'd learn the theories, you'd learn the techniques, and then you'd have to just practice every day. Well, here we're discussing, like I said to, you know, what's your name? Richard, to Richard, we're learning to, the Buddhist approach is wakening up to yourself and using Buddhist psychology, which is very precise. And so this, the view I'm mentioning here, what's your name?
Eric.
Oh, yeah, Eric. Okay, Eric's point. Like, right now, the Buddha would say we have this main neuroses, main delusions, attachment, aversion, and indifference, these three. So attachment's like the motor that runs us. And this is quite a subtle point. I wanted to say it a bit, yeah, okay. Every Buddha says every almost every microsecond we're going along in daily life, and this is why this is so deeply ingrained in our ordinary material model materialist models of the mind. We don't talk like this, okay? So I'm using Buddha's approach. But this attachment is this deep instinctive sense of dissatisfaction, this which brings a deep all the time a yearning, a craving for something, and this is in us all the time. So the obvious, more gross level of that would be to the objects of the senses. Oh, I feel like I need something. What do I need? I'll have a cake. Oh, I'll have this. I'll get a new boyfriend. This is the obvious level, the way attachment works, okay? But at a much subtler level we're talking here, I think, that every second this attachment is kind of desperate to get what it wants every moment. And that would mean the nice sense object. But even in a more subtle way, it means getting the way I want the world to be. The way I want... Okay, I'll use an example, all right? A friend of mine who's very, you know... Depressed people, the aversion goes in, so therefore they're not aggressively angry. A person like me is aggressively angry. So in my life, when I didn't get what I wanted, I would shout and kick and punch. So when I got very politically active, before I was a Buddhist, I was out there demonstrating and screaming and kicking and yelling at whoever needed to be kicked to. You understand what I'm pointing to? Try and make the world a better place. That was my method. So I knew I had aversion. It was very obvious to me and everybody else. But there's another friend of mine recently who's, you know, he's this time around, she's younger generation, she's into the environment. I didn't think of the environment when I was a lefty, a radical old person, you know, it was like, whatever. So her thing is, she wants the world to be a better place too. So when I didn't get the world to be a better place, which was very noble, I had compassion, but my attachment was very distressed when it didn't get the things that I wanted. So I'd shout and yell and kick. So, but she doesn't get angry. She's a very peaceful nature. She wants the world to be a better place, which is a noble thing, but her attachment to having it better means she freaks out completely. So she gets deeply panicked and distressed and has anxiety and depression because it all goes in. Are you sort of seeing what I'm saying? This works at quite a subtle level. So the depression is a... We all have attachment. That means we want not just a chocolate cake every now and again. It means I want what I want every single second. It's quite profound, really, this attachment. So to really be awake to this needs an immense amount of introspection. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this attachment is always there, and it's always dissatisfied, and it always wants something, and it wants nice sounds and nice smells and the world to be the way I want it, if that's your thing. You know? So then her response when it isn't that way, like just recently she emailed me, she's having complete panic attacks because of, you know, Sandy and everything. This is just all the fears, that she said, all the fears I have are becoming true. So huge depression and anxiety. It goes in. Now she doesn't shout and yell and kick. You see what I'm saying here? That's how it, can you recognize what I'm saying? It's quite subtle and it means immense awareness of it, because this is where the answer to your question, how do you change it? It's quite hard, because we're talking here psychologically at stuff that's quite subtle and quite instinctive. So we only notice we have problems. In my case, when I was a kid or older, I only noticed I had anger when the words are vomiting out my mouth. Well, it's a bit late to do anything about it. Vesuvius had just exploded, you know. I've got to learn to see it before that, and that's where this meditation techniques come in, where you can start to see your mind before it gets to the mouth. Now, depressed people only notice it when they can't get out of bed one morning. But again, it's way too late. We only notice because we don't have techniques in our culture to see inside, so we wait till we have a mental breakdown before we go to see a therapist. I mean, we don't treat our computers like that. We have maintenance. We don't treat our cars like that. We know we need to maintain them and have preventative medicine, but we don't have it with our minds, which is a tragedy in our culture. We wait till the symptoms are so severe, and then we see, I've got a problem, what do I do about it? Well, it's a bit late. We've got to go deep inside and really learn to see the thoughts, I could do this cognitive process of changing ourselves well before it gets to the emotional level, which is really hard work. You with me? Okay. That's the approach. Oh, I did it in 7 minutes. Okay. Time to really go. Anybody? Is it 11:40? Is quite strict, is it? We just finished at 11:40.
They run out of their activities to do.
Oh. Okay. Okay, whatever. It's fine. It's cool. I'm happy. Whatever, whatever. So what else? Questions? Well, some more questions. I thought there were some more questions. No? Okay, fine. If not, that's perfect. But I just let me say one thing then, open our minds a bit too here, to understand how, what compassion, well, you know, one, why we, okay, why would I have compassion for an enemy? Let's think that question. That doesn't seem logical to us at all. Why not? Is because our logic, the logic we use, is that as long as a person is an innocent victim, then they deserve compassion. But if they're not innocent, how can, why should we have compassion for them? We think. So forget about the long-term view of karma. There's no point in, there's no time for this. But a really solid basis for having compassion, or seeing how compassion isn't just some sentimental feeling, but to see the logic, one logical reason why we should have compassion for a person who is doing the harming, you know, that's the person we never have compassion for, is because, very simple and very obvious if we think of it carefully, is because they are harming themselves. I think a mother has this compassion for her junky kid. There's her kid. He's an alcoholic. He's a heroin addict. Everybody else can't stand that kid. He lies, he steals, he's horrible to be around. But look at the mother. Her heart breaks for him. Why? Because she can see he's harming himself. So this is a really, I think, a valid reason. You know, Buddha says we all suffer because we've got neurosis, we have attachment, we have anger, we have jealousy, we have pride, we have neurosis. And this is why the wisdom wing, the first step, the first part of the practice, is to learn first to see why I am suffering. I am suffering. So we right now think I'm suffering because, you know, Fred left me. We think we're suffering because the politicians do this and that. We think we're suffering because people are mean. Well, let's face it, the politicians are doing this and that. Fred did leave me. The world is mean. People do terrible things to each other. There is no doubt about this. Of course, there's no time for our deeper question. We're going to discuss this later in the weeks or the whatever we've got, you know, about karma, Buddha's explanation of why this stuff happens. But even here, I think a very powerful reason, if we can bear to think it, is the person who's harming you is harming themselves. Well, the fundamental first point is when you harm others, when you lie, when you steal, when you're angry, when you're neurotic, we've got to see this one first. Forget others now, but this is the basis of compassion for others. It's like compassion for yourself. When we can look into our own minds, instead of having guilt and shame and beat yourself up because you're angry and neurotic, break your heart for yourself. Be in tears for yourself. Have compassion for yourself. Because this is the fundamental Buddhist view. And if we look at it carefully, we can agree. He didn't make this up. He's observed it, that's all. That we harm ourselves. This is crucial to get first. It's impossible to have compassion for people who harm others until we have compassion for ourselves, to see that I harm myself. This takes time. Because our instinct is to have guilt and beat ourselves up. Wrong. So totally wrong. We mightn't have, you know, we can say anger, which is what, okay, this is what guilt is, isn't it? Guilt, depression, they're so linked. I'm bad. I'm no good. It's totally mistaken. It's wrong. Completely mistaken. And this takes so much courage to change. To argue with this every moment that this arises. That I cause my own pain and suffering. Yes, sweetheart. Yes, good, John. It'd be good to have the mic for this. Who, just say it again, sweetheart. It's a really good point.
Can everybody hear me? What is the best course of action when you are in the presence of someone you love who is suffering so deeply,
right, exactly,
that they do not want to get out of
that's
their
right
pain?
That's right. Oh, darling, don't we understand?
What is...
I understand, exactly.
Okay, understand?
I understand exactly. I understand exactly. I think if we see in ourselves, listen to this. Keep the mic, please. Keep the mic. You know, if we... What's your name?
Lee.
If we look into ourselves, Lee, and this is where the first step has to be this, that why we can't bear that is first because we do have compassion for them. But the other one is because we have this terrible neediness and attachment to them being better because we can't bear to see the pain. So part of the answer to that is to do with you, which is not you, but all of us, you understand, to realize, this is what almost like getting them out of the equation again. getting them separate from us, to see that that is their pain. They are unable to see their pain. They don't realize they're harming themselves, and they're so stuck in it they can't move and don't even want to move. All you can do is have your heart break for them, but to have the courage to know that sometimes there's almost nothing you can do except just be there and have the courage to see them and not wish they would be different. That sounds weird, but our own attachment that they be different is often what causes us to manipulate them, to bully them, to push them out of the way, to talk about them behind their back, which causes much more problem. It's just accept this is the way they are. You love them anyway, but be there without trying to make them different, without giving them lectures, without feeling sorry for them. That's our problem. So it takes courage to be this way, because if there is something you can do for them and that they're open to it, which is the point, you can do it. But if there's nothing they're open to, there is zero you can do except accept it in the most healthy way, which is our own inner work, which is very hard. Are we communicating?
Yeah, absolutely. Goodly. Thank you very much.
Because you know yourself, there's nothing worse than everybody in your family all talking about you behind your back, and Paul Lee, she's this, Paul Lee's that, all looking at you sadly, patronizing you. You want to kill them, you know. You understand what I'm saying? Because that's what our attachment causes. We call it compassion, but it's not. It's sticking our nose in your business. So be there like a rock for this person. Love them for who they are. And then if they're ready to change, baby, you'll notice the opportunity and you'll grab it, you know, and you'll help them. But not before they're ready. They've got to be ready for it. Do you understand? Very difficult.
Thank you.
All right, Lee. There's another hand. Yes, sweetie. Over here, Jeanette. Yes.
Could you please then summarize the concept of love in the Buddhist realm? The concept of love helps.
Love is delighting in the happiness of others and wanting to make them happy, regardless of whether they're friends, enemies, or strangers. That's what we're aiming for. That's it. That's the essence of it. That's a definition of it. And it's the growing of that which takes time. Do you hear that?
Could I ask you to repeat it one more time, please?
Okay, love is an attitude in your mind that you're trying to grow, that is that you want people to be happy. It's a sincere wish that they be happy. Your heart reaches out and you want them to be happy. And then if you see ways of making them happy, you will take it. And that you have this for enemies, friends, and strangers. In other words, to every being in the universe. Are you hearing me? So way to go, baby. It's like trying to say, play music like Mozart overnight. No, we've got to grow towards it, step by baby step. And then when we see the obstacles to why we haven't got that this moment, it's because of the presence of attachment, ignorance, and aversion, which is all the hard work in the wisdom wing to get to that point of slowly accomplishing this amazing state of mind. This is like highly advanced. It's sort of like, you know, you graduate after years and years of getting this step by baby step towards that. That's the goal. And that's what Buddha would say is the potential of every being. But we've got to grow there slowly. You can't just sort of close your eyes and hope to have it and it comes. You've got to go one step at a time. Practice, 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 which is internal work. Does that make sense? Good. Yes.
Does it not depend then on what makes them happy? Because what if what makes them happy?
But the first step, yeah, no, truly.
Hurts themselves or even possibly hurts others.
Absolutely, but the first step has to be your wish to make them happy. And then the ability to know what to do to make them happy can only come when you rid yourself of your neuroses and your projections and your needs and what you think they want. That's what wisdom is. Seeing them really clearly for who they are, having the wisdom to know how to make them happy. That's the tricky part. But the first step is the wish to make them. The first step is to recognize they want to be happy. Then the wish to make them happy. And then knowing how to make them happy. It takes a lot of time, step by step. Clarity, wisdom, getting rid of your own junk. Do you see what I'm saying? Which is the Buddhist path. Make sense? Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like a good end. Okay, go, sweetheart. The back. The microphone, darling, so I can hear you. Yes.
So it's more important for your wish for them to, even if they're hurting themselves.
Yes.
It's more important to for them to be happy than for you to help them overcome hurting themselves. Does that make
sense? I don't quite get it. Say it a bit another way, darling.
So it's more important to for you to just to kind of be hands-off and let them be happy, even if they're
no, no, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Okay.
No, my God, no. No, no,
okay.
No, sweetheart. What? I, first of all, these words, we've got to be, okay. This first step that we discussed before, equanimity, was simply this bare-bones recognition that they want to be happy. That doesn't mean that they're doing what will make them happy. They're mostly doing what will make them suffer, for God's sake. That first to recognize they want to be happy, which is for your sake, to get out of the belief that, you know, to get out of your own neediness that they be happy because they're making you happy, is to see them more objectively, that they want to be happy. Then you see that even what they're doing, having heroin, killing people, is because they think that'll make them happy. Honey, they're deluded. It's painfully suffering to see that they're, what they're doing to themselves. So you, what I'm saying here is, what wisdom is, Lee's point, is because we can see clearly the person's harming themselves and harming others. We can see it. So what we do is we leap in. Often out of our own neurosis and anxiety and attachment is my point. So what I'm saying is, if a person who is harming themselves, but as Lee pointed out, the person she said was they are harming themselves and it's like they're not showing any sign that they want to change, then there's no benefit in sticking your nose in their business and telling them what to do. That's my point. But if they ask you, please help me, oh my God, help them every way you can. But what my point is, and again his point, what we do now, because we have a lot of attachment and neediness that they be a certain way, that blinds our ability to see them more clearly and to see really what is the best way to help them. Often we try, we shout, we yell, we're just making a mess. So what I'm saying is keep out of the way if they're not ready to hear what you have to say. Not just don't help them. I don't mean it like that at all. Are you kind of seeing the difference?
Oh, yeah.
It's huge. Listen, the key point is here, again, because of our own attachment, our need that they be a certain way, we make a mess of it. Because even if they're not ready for us, we tell them what to do. We know what it's like when mummy sticks her nose in our business. We wish she'd back off, right? But when a person is ready to be helped and you've got the wisdom to see it because you're not so sticking yourself in it, then you can be really wise in your ability and you should be willing to help them. But when the time is right, they've got to want to be helped. You understand my point here?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So that means wisdom, which is what you get when you get rid of your own attachment. Then you see them more clearly, more objectively. You don't have to leap in every minute. We leap into each other's business the whole time and we make a mess 90% of the time. And then we call it love. It is not. It's often fulfilling our own attachment's needs. So that's where we've got to first look into our own mind to be clear and then have the courage, like I said to Lee, even you see them harming themselves terribly, but they're not open to your advice. So how can you help them? The best is not give up on them. Always want them to be happy in your heart and be ready to help them when they're ready to be helped.
And that's when the wisdom wing comes
that's
in.
That's exactly right.
And that's absolutely why you work on wisdom first.
You've got to have that first.
Okay.
And wisdom is getting rid of your own neuroses so you can see them more clearly. You're more skillful. You're more wise. You understand? That's a huge one, that. Because we're all suffering. We're all doing something. And you know, our first people, our friends and our family never stop. We all know. They never stop talking about it. Like I said, behind our back. Everybody's worried, worried, worried. But that's our own neurosis half the time. You know? But to really see the difference between our neurosis and the person's problem. Because if I'm really neurotic, your problem will look 10 times worse to me than you even think it is. So it's really not very accurate what we're saying. You understand my point? But if you've got less neurosis, you'll be more brave in the face of my problem and you'll treat me with more respect and more dignity and I will know that and I'll trust you more. Then I'll want you to help me. But if you're all over me like a rash, I wish you'd back off, you know? You understand? Okay. Yes. Yes.
To follow up with what she said, suppose you're the person that has the wisdom to back off and be ready.
Yes.
How do you deal with the people, the busybodies that come in and say, no, no, you should be doing
that's
this.
That's right. I know. It's really, whatever way you go, you're going to have trouble. It's whatever, you can't win, you know. Because we all have so much attachment and neediness, we all think sticking our nose into each other's business is helping. And it's very hard. So you can't win, sweetheart. You've got to do your best, that's all. And have the courage to be there and let people think what they like and talk about you behind your back because you're not helping your best friend. What can you do? You can't. You need a lot of courage to do this, you know, to have this wisdom. You can't convince everybody. We can't help it sometimes. You have to let people do what they have to do. Isn't it?
That's true.
I know. Difficult. What do you think? That'll do? Food for thought? Bit of food for thought, okay. Let's do our trip then. What do we do? Do our thing. Do the holy bits now. We can do the holy bits.
First, I'd like to thank our sponsors. Anonymous person, this person's dedication for Elizabeth, Mike, and Jake White, and Bruce Antoloni. May they be blessed with true happiness and prosperity for the benefit of themselves and all beings.
Say what sponsors means.
That was anonymous.
I know, but say what sponsors means.
Oh.
People might know what the word sponsor means.
All of the teachings that we have from our special teachers, such as Venerable Rubina, are all due to the kindness of our sponsors. The center.
What she means is they give money.
Thank you.
She's being so polite. Sponsors give money because money makes the world go round.
Right.
That pays the fares and all that kind of thing. You know, that's what it means by sponsor.
Right. And the center does not have this income. It's all non-profit.
I'm Australian. You see, we were allowed to be blunt. Go on.
Okay.
So we thank you all the sponsors.
And the other anonymous sponsor. May the wishes and prayers of Venerable Robina and all our precious teachers be instantly fulfilled. May the prayers for all on the dedication list be instantly fulfilled for Venerable Robina's very long, very healthy, very happy life. Peter Murphy, for the long life and happiness of Lama Zopa Rinpoche and all of our precious teachers. That's all.
That's it? Okay. That's all. No more prayers.
Yes, I have.
Now we sing the prayers.
Okay. So if you look at the pink page in our white prayer book, do the prayer on the top. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May their powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other.
That's it? Okie doke. Thank you, everybody. See you next time.